is Friday, May 15th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Samsung Electronics and the government are urging the company's largest union to resume talks ahead of a planned strike next week. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we'll examine the Trump-Xi summit in Beijing, including what the two leaders agreed on over Iran and the Strait of Hormuz, and whether North Korea has slipped down Washington's priority list. And on Movie Spotlight, we review two very different releases, the Korean indie Wrangler and Michael, the Michael Jackson biopic. Let's start Korea 24 right now. A general strike is set to go ahead at Samsung Electronics in a little less than a week unless the two sides reach a last-minute deal. The company's largest labor union is adamant that it won't back down unless changes are made to the bonus payout system. But in a pleading statement, the chipmaker has asked it to return to the table for more talks. Meanwhile, the industry minister says the government may intervene if necessary to stop the strikes. For more details about this story and other news of the day, we're joined now in the studio by KBS News editor Eileen Cahill. Hello, Eileen.
Hello, Alana.
Eileen, what's the latest on the labour dispute at the nation's largest chipmaker?
The company's largest labour union has presented a set of demands that include setting bonuses at 15% of operating profit, eliminating the payout cap, and establishing a standardised bonus system. Talks broke down earlier this week, and despite requests to come back to the table, the union now says it won't budge unless its demands are met. The 18-day strike is set to begin next Thursday.
And I know the company issued a statement today to try to persuade the union to resume talks. What did that statement say?
Well, the company's top management is essentially pleading with the union to return to the negotiations, saying it's prepared to engage in open dialogue without any preconditions. The top management also apologized to the public for causing concerns over the situation, admitting its own failure to meet the public's expectations. The statement said the management views the labor union as family and a community of shared destiny, and it urged the union to consider public concerns and the broader impact of a strike on the national economy.
Well, speaking of impact, what exactly could that look like?
Well, in a recent post on X, Industry Minister Kim Jong-kwon said a strike must be prevented at all costs due to its implications for the economy. He said a halt in production at the company's plants could cost up to 100 trillion won, or roughly 66.8 billion U.S. dollars, and could severely impact 1,700 suppliers. Kim also said the importance of Samsung Electronics to South Korea's economy cannot be overstated, and that a strike could lead to irreversible economic damage in the form of lost jobs, income, and trust within the global supply chain. He said the semiconductor industry is basically the country's only core strategic asset and that it's important to stay competitive as other countries are expanding their footprint in the market.
So is the company any closer to meeting the union's demands?
No, unfortunately, there's no sign of that so far. Samsung's management says it's committed to providing higher bonuses than its competitor, SK Hynix, and it argues that the bonus structure should reflect differences during industry up cycles and down cycles. Under the company's latest proposal, employees would be eligible for performance bonuses exceeding 10% of operating profit during profitable periods like the current one, and there would be no cap on payouts. But during downturns, the chipmaker wants to maintain the current system. That's something the union doesn't want.
Well, as we mentioned, the government has said that it might intervene if the two sides cannot reach a deal. I mean, what exactly would that mean?
Well, in cases where a labor dispute is likely to cause significant harm to the national economy, the labor minister has the authority to invoke emergency arbitration. That means the union would be required to call a halt to all industrial action for 30 days. The government has also been trying to break the deadlock and urge both sides to resume dialogue. But on Friday, in his post on X, the industry minister said the government may have no choice but to invoke its emergency arbitration powers if no deal is struck.
Well, while Samsung continues to try and settle that bonus dispute, the benchmark Korea Composite stock price index broke the 8,000 mark for the first time in intraday trading Friday. Even so, the index did end below 7,500 after a sharp decline. What exactly happened?
According to the Korea Exchange, the KOSPI closed at 7,493.18, down 488.23 points, which is more than 6%. This is the second largest decline on record, and the difference between the highest and lowest points in intraday trading was 675.1 points.
It's quite a gap. Eileen, can you give us the details?
The main bourse opened down 29.66 points, or 0.37% from the previous session, at 7,951.75, then turned upward to hit 8,046.78. This is just seven sessions after breaching 7,000 points for the first time. But the KOSPI tumbled on profit-taking, and the authorities halted program selling for the first time in a month during afternoon trading. This is because the KOSPI 200 futures index fell 5.09% from the previous trading day to 1,182 points. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also lost 61.27 points, or 5.14%, to close at 1,129.82.
Well, in other news, the world's eyes have been on Beijing as U.S. President Donald Trump wrapped up a three-day state visit. Eileen, what can you tell us about the final day of Trump's visit to Beijing?
Considering the situation in the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz, it's not surprising that those issues were part of the agenda. But there seems to have been a disconnect on which issues dominated the talks. The two leaders didn't issue a joint declaration or sign an agreement, and the handouts distributed by the White House and the Chinese Foreign Ministry emphasized very different issues. The Chinese side stayed silent about the Iran issue, and the U.S. side kept quiet on Taiwan.
What did we hear from Trump? How did he sum up this visit?
He said China was beautiful, the visit was great, and he and Xi made fantastic trade deals. He also said Xi wants to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Here's what he told Fox News' Sean Hannity shortly after the summit.
President Xi would like to see a deal made. He would like to see a deal made. And he did offer, he said, if I can be of any help at all, I would like to be of help.
Because, he did say that.
Yeah, he did say that. And look, anybody that buys that much oil has obviously got some kind of a relationship with him. But he said, I would love to be a help. If I can be of any help whatsoever, he'd like to see the Hormuz Strait open. He said, if I could be of any help whatsoever, I would like to help.
And what about the Taiwan issue?
Trump declined to say whether they discussed the topic at all. But a statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-U.S. relations. If it's handled properly, the statement said, the bilateral relationship will thrive, but otherwise the two countries will get into clashes and even conflicts.
And what's the takeaway from that?
Some analysts have said that if the U.S. is seeking Chinese support as leverage in the Iran war, there will be a cost, with some suggesting that that might mean compromising on Taiwan.
Well, we are going to delve into this summit even further with two experts later in the show, so do stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, Eileen, what do you have for our next story?
There's more news from the Middle East. Indian authorities say an Indian-flagged cargo vessel has sunk after being attacked in waters near the Strait of Hormuz. India's shipping ministry said the wooden cargo ship, the Haji Ali, was attacked in the early hours of Wednesday morning off the coast of Oman, then caught fire and sank.
And was anyone hurt?
No, all 14 crew members on board were rescued by the Omani Coast Guard. The vessel was sailing to the United Arab Emirates from Somalia, and the Indian government didn't provide any background or say exactly what happened. But the British Maritime Risk Management Group, Vanguard, said a drone or missile strike may have caused an explosion.
Of course, this calls to mind the recent attack on the HMM Namu and the ongoing investigation on that South Korean cargo ship. Has any more information come to light in that case?
The remnants of the objects that struck the South Korean-operated HMM Namu in the Strait of Hormuz last week have arrived here for close examination. The foreign ministry told reporters on Friday that the debris arrived in South Korea by air for a thorough lab analysis after being retrieved from the vessel. And for people who may not remember, the 38,000-ton cargo ship was attacked last week with 24 crew members on board while it was stranded in the strait. And of course, the strait is basically closed. The South Korean government sent inspectors to a port in Dubai where the vessel was towed and concluded that two aerial objects had struck the port side of the stern.
Next, we have another domestic story. Eileen, what can you tell us about the latest export price figures?
Prices of South Korean exports soared to a 28-year high in April amid rising prices in the semiconductor industry. According to data from the Bank of Korea on Friday, the export price index stood at 187.4. That's its highest point since it posted 196.01 in March 1998.
And what's behind these trends?
Computers, electronic equipment, and optical instruments led the price hikes. And this is primarily due to the weakening currency. The import price index, on the other hand, dropped for the first time in 10 months in April. And that reflects a decline in global oil prices since March.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thank you so much, Eileen, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm baritone Tae-han Kim, winner of the Queen Elizabeth competition. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping met at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing on Thursday amid mounting geopolitical tensions and stalled U.S.-Iran negotiations to end the war and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. According to the White House, Trump and Xi agree that the strait must remain open and that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. Trump later said Xi was willing to help on Hormuz if needed, while also saying China would not provide military equipment to Iran. On trade, Trump said China agreed to buy U.S. soybeans, oil, liquefied natural gas and 200 Boeing jets. To help us unpack what the summit achieved and what it means for the region, we're joined today on the line by two guests. First, we have Professor David Araze from Johns Hopkins University's Nanjing Center. Hello, Professor Araze.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Professor Joel Atkinson from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Great to have you with us, Professor Atkinson.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, before we get into the specific deals and pressure points, let's start with the overall tone of this meeting. Professor Araze, what is your overall read on the summit? Did this look like a substantive reset in U.S.-China relations or maybe a more like a managed pause in tensions?
Well, what struck me was the atmospherics of this visit. Very friendly. And, it seemed as though, you know, just from the superficial body language and the pomp and circumstance that, everything, all the problems between these two great powers are being managed successfully. But I think if you look at the level of substance, we haven't seen anything fundamentally change. But what we did get from both sides was a commitment to try to maintain stable, predictable bilateral relations for the rest of Trump's term. And this is what he called for at the welcoming formal dinner. And the United States did not disagree with that at all. In fact, in Trump's comments, he did everything to kind of reinforce that, that message, but without specifically endorsing the language that China uses to describe how the relationship must develop going forward.
Mm-hmm. Professor Atkinson, let me put that same question to you. What stood out most for you from the Trump-Xi meeting?
Yeah, well, I think I had a very similar kind of impression to Professor Araze. I think both sides are seeking to continue their detente, to continue this competitive but not overtly confrontational relationship. So I thought, that's what we saw at the summit. The two sides don't agree on much, so their readouts highlighted different things. But at the same time, they're also not loudly and directly contradicting each other. You know, to be frank, that means it was kind of boring, I guess, apart from some journalists getting kept in a dark room or whatever, or Elon Musk bringing his son along. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. There are much worse things than boring, either in the direction of cooperation if you were more of a hawk, or in the direction of confrontation if you're more of a dove.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into more into those readouts and some of the things that the two sides did appear to agree on, let's discuss what each side actually came into this summit perhaps wanting. Professor Araze, what was the single most important objective Beijing hoped to achieve from this summit? And would you say President Xi ultimately got what he wanted?
Well, I think the, you know, officially, for the past year, you know, China has been pressing the United States to change its stance on Taiwan, that is to restrict arms sales, and, you know, also to shift. It's a subtle shift, but a very important shift in its attitude towards Taiwan's independence. The existing policy is that the U.S. will not support any move in this direction. But China was pressing the U.S. to commit to oppose any such move. And here on this point, China did not get what it wanted. But there are a number of other more subtle things that China wanted that I think it achieved. For example, you know, when it comes to the status or the kind of relationship that the two sides have, I think that the visit, China wanted to send a message to the rest of the world that China is today America's preferred partner in managing world affairs, and this kind of message is not going to be welcomed by U.S. friends and allies around the world. I think to some extent they succeeded in getting this message across through the coverage of the meeting. Next, I think China, for the domestic audience, wanted to put Trump in an inferior status to Xi. I think they succeeded in doing this. China also knew it could not get the big concessions it wanted on Taiwan, but they were able to subtly redefine this Taiwan issue. You know, ever since Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in 2022, China has used military intimidation and outright rehearsals for economic blockades and military invasions. And the fact that the U.S. did not bring this up at all as a point of criticism kind of normalizes the situation. And that has to be viewed as a very subtle move, moving the ball forward, so to speak, towards China's goal line of unifying with Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And China also won by, you know, giving the appearance of cooperating with the U.S. by giving symbolic concessions across a range of U.S. issues, but, you know, nothing really substantive. So I think that has to be viewed as a win for China.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, and I think most importantly for China, they got an extension of the trade war truce and a commitment from the U.S. to try to maintain stable trade relations.
Mm-hmm. From the U.S. perspective, Professor Atkinson, what did Washington hope to achieve going into this meeting? And would you say that President Trump realized that objective?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, to start with, the U.S. has lots of things going on in terms of objectives and trying to realize those objectives. And you could write whole books about trying to figure out what those are, and, you know, people are writing those books. But here, just for Trump personally, I would focus on his effort to manage perceptions, to create certain expectations. Professor Araze mentioned the kind of normalcy. He wants the stock market to go up. He wants economic sentiment to improve, bringing all those business leaders, saying that China will improve access for U.S. companies, buy Boeing jets, buy oil, invest in the U.S. Even if these don't end up really happening in a substantial way, it creates that momentum, that sentiment that the stock market will keep rising, and this sense that there's not about to be a war over Taiwan or whatever, that Iran is going to work out. And I think he realized that objective at least to some degree, at that level of atmospherics. The market is up. The US-China atmosphere feels relaxed, but we'll have to see how durable that is leading into the US midterm elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, while trade seemed to shape much of this summit, one of the most immediate tests of cooperation may be the Strait of Hormuz and, of course, the war in Iran. The White House says the two sides agree that the strait must remain open and that Iran can never have nuclear weapons. Professor Araze, do you think that that agreement will help the US gain leverage in its stalled negotiations with Iran?
Well, you know, the situation is very, very complicated. I think that there are two aspects. One is who's making decisions in Iran. It seems that in just the recent days, there's been a shift in decision making inside Iran, so that the IRGC seems to have become a paramount decision maker. And if that's the case, then I don't believe that these diplomatic considerations are going to hold much sway over them. But as far as China is concerned, you know, when China says that Iran should not have nuclear weapons, that's not quite the same thing as saying that Iran doesn't have the right to enrich nuclear material or have uranium and enrich it, you know, for whatever purposes it wants. So, you know, it's not exactly the same thing as saying Iran has to turn over its uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, of course, Xi pledged not to sell weapons to Iran. But the problem isn't that China is selling weapons to Iran, you know, finished weapons to Iran today. The problem is that it's private Chinese firms are supplying dual use services, materials, parts, and components to Iran, which Iran uses to create missiles and drones and to target U.S. forces in the region. So, you know, on the face of it, it sounds very good. But if you look at the details, you know, it begins to become much more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Professor Atkinson, ultimately, what role can China realistically play in Middle East diplomacy?
I think China plays a very important role in sustaining Iran's economy and its military potency. It calibrates that role in a way that avoids making the US, Israel, and the Arab countries too upset, while also doing enough in terms of supporting Iran to keep them unhappy. And on the one hand, China wants that oil supply stabilized. It wants the conflict to come to an end, but it also seems confident that it can get that while still making the US take a bit of a strategic hit. So I think realistically, China's not going to be doing very much to help the US solve its Iran problem or its, you know, what you could call its overall Middle East situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move now from security back to trade and economics. Top US business and technology industry executives, including Tesla CEO Elon Musk, NVIDIA's Jensen Huang and Tim Cook of Apple, they were all in Beijing with Trump, obviously highlighting that trade was a top priority for the US. Professor Araze, what gains would you say the US made in terms of opening up China to US firms?
Well, I don't think U.S. goals were entirely met in this visit. Boeing ended up signing a deal to supply only 200 planes to China, whereas going into this meeting, the talk was about, you know, 500 planes. And when Trump visited in 2017, Boeing signed a deal for 300 planes. So Boeing stock actually fell after this news. Beef and pork purchases, soybean purchases, you know, these kinds of things were China pledged, but we have no details. And so it's difficult to assess whether, you know, how significant these changes will be. Tesla went, you know, Musk went there, you know, wanting to sell Tesla robots and driverless cars in China. Nothing seems to, we don't have any news on that. And I think from the U.S. side, the U.S. wanted to set up a board of trade and a board of investment to monitor bilateral trade and manage it in ways that would allow for normal trade in some categories and more restricted trade in others. And, you know, we didn't get an agreement from the Chinese side that they would get on board with this. So I think that although, you know, the Boeing deal is nice, it's a nice deal to sort of, you know, flog to the press. I'm not sure that the trade deals that come out of this are any kind of game changer.
Mm-hmm. Well, we briefly touched on the trade truce that Trump and Xi reached after their meeting in South Korea in October. Professor Atkinson, can we expect that truce to continue?
Yes, I do expect it to continue. The tariffs did what they could do. Bilateral U.S.-China trade has been greatly reduced. There's an increase in investment outside of China and even in the U.S. to avoid the kind of instability the tariffs created. But tariffs are not able to address the trade deficit, which clears globally, not bilaterally. They're not able to force China to rebalance its economy or sign up to that board of trade idea. And Washington wants to keep receiving Chinese rare earths as the alternatives to that take time. And regardless, tariffs push up inflation in a politically toxic way. So I think he's not interested in kind of restarting the tariff war. And, you know, there are things that China is unhappy about, especially tech controls, but it's also content with the status quo of a quiet struggle rather than an open economic conflict, which would further reduce foreign investment in China and put further pressure on exports at a time when the Chinese economy is, you know, increasingly hitting up against the limits of that kind of investment-driven growth model.
I want to rewind for a moment because in the run-up to this summit and even during it, it had raised the possibility that Trump may use the meeting with Xi as a chance to also meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Obviously, that's not happened. Professor Araze, why do you think that is, and what does that tell us about the current state of diplomacy with Pyongyang?
Well, there's a simple answer and a more complicated answer to this question. The simple answer is that, you know, the Trump White House has limited bandwidth to deal with, you know, major diplomatic initiatives because it's the Trump approach is it takes place of, you know, personal envoys. And all these envoys have been busy, you know, dealing with Russia, Ukraine, Iran, and China itself. So lack of bandwidth to pay attention to the Korean Peninsula, that's a kind of the simple technical answer. But the more sort of complicated and substantive answer is that, you know, for the U.S. to meet with North Korea now could be seen to normalize North Korea's status as a nuclear-armed state, which, you know, Russia recognizes, and even U.S. in fact, in recent years hasn't denied it. Recent months hasn't denied it. So I don't think the Trump administration wants to do anything like have a formal meeting with North Korea that could be interpreted as the U.S. accepting its status as as a nuclear power. And then beyond that, of course, just in recent days, North Korea, according to certain press reports, has ordered that the nuclear strikes would be automatic if any threat against the life of the leader is attempted.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the face of this kind of behavior, I don't think that the atmosphere, the timing is right for any kind of meeting between the two. But that's not to say that that a meeting couldn't happen in the future, but I think that right now the timing just isn't right.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we run out of time, there is one more media report that I do briefly want to touch on. According to Xinhua News Agency, Trump and Xi did share their views on the Korean Peninsula, although nothing specific was disclosed on that topic. Professor Atkinson, do you think North Korea and peninsula issues have just become a lower priority now for Washington?
Well, it is a lower priority than other issues. You know, Iran is the priority. Trump wants that resolved. Taiwan is a priority, as that is the focus of that kind of competition with China. And unlike Biden, Trump doesn't seem to be as concerned about North Korea's cooperation with Russia. But at the same time, I think I would emphasize North Korea's chosen to not make itself a priority, both through not conducting any nuclear tests, etc., but also by not wanting to have major talks at the current level of conditions or preconditions. But low priority doesn't mean less important. Mm-hmm. North Korea is more military potent than ever, and it certainly will become a priority again when I think North Korea decides to leverage that capability that it now has.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's all that we have time for today. A big thank you to Professor David Araze from the Johns Hopkins University's Nanjing Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Araze.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And thank you as well to Professor Joel Atkinson from Hanguk University of Foreign Studies for sharing your insights. Great to have you with us, Professor Atkinson.
Welcome to the Korea 24 stock market update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index plummeted 488.23 points or 6.12% on Friday to close at 7,493.18. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 61.27 points or 5.14% to close at 1,129.82. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Let's get straight into our first story today.
We have some figures on newly ordained priests in Korea. According to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Korea, the number of new priests in the nation has been rapidly declining. In the past 10 years, the number of new priests has decreased by half.
Okay, give us more details on those figures.
So in the last 10 years, the number of new priests per year has been on a constant decline. The total number of newly ordained priests between 2025 and early 2026 stood at only around 70. That's a huge dip compared to the three-digit figures from 2015, which was 154.
And other than the decline of newly ordained priests, what were some other standout figures?
Well, the total number of registered priests in the nation surpassed 7,100, with the number of active Korean priests today standing around 5,700, both figures showing on-year hikes. However, last year, 773 priests passed away. That's 34 more than the previous year.
And Daniel, is this just within the Catholic Church?
Yes, the majority of the priests belong to the Catholic Church in Korea. Following them is nearly 900 priests, part of missionary orders, and some 20 in the Vatican or other overseas dioceses. There are about 114 foreign priests residing in Korea beside them.
Let's move on now to our next story. What do you have for us?
The Seoul Han River Ultra Marathon, originally set to be held this Saturday, has been postponed, puzzling as the race is being held for the third straight year.
Lots of disappointed runners, I'm sure. What was the reason for this postponement?
According to Seoul City officials, the organizers failed to secure venue permission from Duksam Han River Park. Instead, they only sought permits from the start and finish line venue in Dongdaemun-gu, Dongdaemun District. City officials issued a warning to the race organizers that they would have a zero-tolerance approach.
And was there really no way for the organisers and, of course, the officials to work something out to try and ensure that this event, as you said, could go ahead for a third year?
There's already a major event set to be held on Saturday at Duksum River Park, an event which is the drone light show. Mm. City officials were even planning to file a criminal complaint against the marathon organisers, citing pedestrian safety. 30,000 people are expected at a drone light show and about 1,500 were registered for the ultramarathon.
And Daniel, have we heard any response from these runners who I'm sure have trained now for many months and were hoping to compete this weekend?
Yes, we did. The participants already signed up for this Hull Han River Ultramarathon expressed deep disappointment and outrage online over the organizers' failure to follow such protocols. Speaking of protocols, for future references, those who plan to organize such events, the rule is this: any event with more than 500 people must be planned and registered with the relevant city authorities during one of two submission windows, one in September and the other in March.
And a reminder that permits really, really matter. Now, what's our last story for today?
Nobel-winning author Han Gang is set to make a surprise appearance at a special event held in Germany this September.
Very exciting. First, can you tell us more about this program that Han Gang will be part of?
She will be doing a reading for a special literary exchange performance program the Berlin Philharmonic has planned for the 2026-2027 season in collaboration with the Berlin International Literature Festival. Kang will do her reading on their opening day, September 7th. Tickets will go on sale on June 7th. Pre-sales begin June 6th.
And other than Han Gang, were there any other writers invited to this event?
Yes, there will be other world-acclaimed authors invited to read their latest works and engage in discussion with the audience. For now, only the very first invited guest author has been revealed, and that is, of course, Han Gang.
Now, this is an event, as you mentioned, that's planned with the Berlin Philharmonic. Any special performances by the orchestra during the sessions?
Of course. Members of the Berlin Philharmonic will perform chamber works that echo and extend the themes of the text. The orchestra wrote on their website that the event has been planned to put music and literature together in dialogue, describing that literature, like music, reflects the world and our lives.
Well, it sounds like a really meaningful moment for Korean literature on the international stage. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm violinist Randall Boosby, and you are listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
How do I know you didn't abandon him to save your own skin?
No one could have lost more than I.
Well, the next time I have a good one, we should take a video from there.
It's time now for Movie Spotlight, your weekly ticket to the world of film, from the hottest blockbusters to hidden indie gems and everything in between. And joining us today in the studio are our resident movie critics, Jason Betrovese. Welcome, Jason.
Hello, Alana.
And Mark Raymond. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
Jason, you're back from Italy.
I am.
Your pick this week is the Korean independent film Wrangler, directed by Salt & Son. Tell us a bit more about it.
Yes, so the reason I selected this film for this week is because it's a CAFA film, so a film produced by the Korean Academy of Film Arts. Whenever I see that name, I always, you know, take notice. And, you know, it's one of the leading film schools in Korea. And, you know, I'm always on the hunt for a new, young, emerging talent. As a, you know, a fan of Korean cinema, and you know, this has an impressive alumnus, you know, Bong Joon-ho, Choi Dong-hoon, Im Sang-soo, among others, Jang Jun-hwan as well. This film was directed by Son Son, like you say, and she graduated from CAFA in directing actually, you know, more than 10 years ago. So, this is her second CAFA project. The first CAFA project was a short film, Hot Summer Night, back in 2015, that premiered at the Mise en Scène Film Festival, which takes place in June. And also, you know, a great place for up-and-coming filmmakers. It's a big kind of local industry event. So Wrangler is her feature debut. It features some new faces too. Che Sung-yun, Kim Sung-hwa, who was in The Glory, and, a few others. And, the setup is relatively simple. It's set in this kind of fairly remote area, and it follows this character. She's a dog trainer called Hayoung, played by Che Sung-yun, and she's basically suddenly visited by her younger sister. Now, her younger sister has a criminal record for murder. She's called Sora, and she just kind of acts really weirdly. I mean, she's quite manipulative. She speaks informally to people she doesn't really know, mm-hmm. and people she works with. And there are clearly issues regarding the upbringing of both Sora and her older sister. And so they're both basically dealing with this trauma that happened earlier on in their life, and it kind of comes back, to haunt them. And then there is this metaphor as well, because you've got this wild dog on the loose attacking people, and they try to kind of subdue it and there's clear parallels to, given what's happening in their minds as well, and they struggle with their trauma. It's screened at the Vancouver Film Festival, Madrid Films by Women, and the 2026 Gothenburg Film Festival. And that's pretty much it in terms of the overview.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you've mentioned so far about the plot, Jason, it sounds like this film's dealing with some quite dark past. You mentioned trauma.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away, but it's pretty obvious from the beginning, from the get-go, really, that that these two female characters are dealing with some problems. There's one of the co-workers as well. She's dealing with she's an alcoholic, so there's a lot going on in there, and so it's pretty. Yeah, I mean, Kaffir films are bleak. Mark will know this. That they tend to deal with some pretty heavy, depressing issues, and so this is not unusual in that sense. Although, I wish it was a little bit more. I mean, the problem sometimes with these films, Korean films, when they're dealing with these problems, you get to the end of the film, you get to the kind of the climatic sequence where things boil over. Yeah, and this was, a classic example of that. And there's more violence and. Yeah, and so it was completely kind of expected. It follows those traditional, typical tropes, not just in film, but particularly kind of Korean indie genre cinema, not least the films coming out of CAFA. Quite dour, but compared to some films, it's not too bad. Or maybe I'm just used to it. Maybe I'm just familiar with too many of these movies.
It sounds like there might not be a happy ending to this.
Not quite. Well, if you think about some of the Kaffir films, like one's called Bleak Night, and then there's others as well, which are actually terrific. These are great graduate projects, films produced by new generation of filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Alison Ernest Land, Social Phobia. And actually, we spoke about some of these on the show. Square.
I was going to say.
They're branching out into animation. And I'm really, they did this a few years ago. And there was a conversation about, whether they want to continue doing that. And because animated films just take so long to produce, mm-hmm. don't they? And such an arduous process. But there are films that are still coming out of CAFA. En Route 2, which was one of the better films at Busan last year.
How do you think this film Wrangler stacks up to those other CAFA films?
I don't know what Mark thinks, but I kind of know what he thinks about this film. It wouldn't surprise me if he's not overly keen on it. Am I right?
Go on, Mark. Yeah.
You're correct. It just feels a bit contrived, to say the least. Yeah. It doesn't feel organic, and mm-hmm. it's obviously reliant on these devices that you see so often in these movies. The dialing up of the tension. You have this this disturbed younger sister who clearly is going to cause problems, and you know, it's all very kind of expected. You know, I did like some of the performances, though, you know, so it wasn't all that bad. I thought the first half of the film was stronger. It's just when the second half, where it just, you know, it kind of does that thing, which, like I said earlier, with Korean indie films, it just wants to kind of up the tension, mm-hmm. you know, make it more, you know, gets a bit darker, more violent. And, you know, for me, I knew exactly what was coming. And that's where it just becomes totally dependent and reliant on established conventions. Mm-hmm. And as a filmmaker, you need to kind of break away from those. And it feels like as the film was carrying on, it couldn't veer off, and it just heads in this, you know, in a direction that, you know, I've seen far too many times.
Mark, did you have similar issues with that kind of predictability as well?
Yeah, I think Jason sums it up fairly well. I've been watching actually a lot of these kind of indie kind of drama or genre kind of films. So just one isn't, I guess but it has those kind of, it feels generic in a weird way, even though it's maybe not technically, you know, a thriller necessarily. It just ends up feeling very sort of cliched. It doesn't really bring much new to the table. You know, and like Jason said, the performances are fine, and you know, it's well made, like all these Kafa films tend to be.
Sure. Yeah. And they have to go through this like vigorous process where they almost in tears, by you know, because of the professors basically scolding them for not making it well enough. Sorry, I just want to throw that in there.
Yeah, I totally. Yeah, so it has. I mean, you know, it's not a terrible film by any means. It just, isn't kind of the kind of breakout film that you sometimes see out of these. From Kafa or from these kind of independent films. And so, but, you know, yeah, it's, me potentially the director with future talent, mm-hmm. This one is just, mediocre, mm-hmm. we'd say, like, okay, but not, it doesn't really reach those kind of heights that some of these indie films do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're going to pivot now from the smaller Korean independent film to a much bigger, glossier production. The big foreign release this week is Michael. It's the biopic of the legendary pop star Michael Jackson. It's already made more than $200 million at the US box office in its first 2 weeks. Mark, tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, well, this is basically a telling of the first 30 years of Michael Jackson's life, beginning with his childhood, where he's, of course, performing with his in a musical group, the Jackson 5, with his four older brothers. And he's only around 10 years old when he begins. And they're under the management of his tyrannical father, Joseph Jackson. And eventually they get signed to Motown Records. And we see this, and we see basically them becoming this huge sensation. And it also becomes clear that Michael is the most talented, mm-hmm. of the group, and the one that is the breakout kind of star. And then the film kind of skips ahead to him as a young adult, where he's basically trying to move away from his family, even though he is still kind of attached to them. So there's that's kind of the tension of the film, and especially trying to break free of his father's influence. And so we see him making his legendary albums, such as Off the Wall, and then especially Thriller in 1982, which turns him into arguably the most famous person in the world for in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And I'm old enough to remember when Thriller came out when I was a kid, and yeah, it was kind of everywhere. And so he continues, however, to tour with his brothers under his father's kind of demands. And then kind of there's this key traumatic incident where his hair catches on fire during this Pepsi commercial that he was kind of forced into by his father. And so the last act of the film is him basically recovering from that and then again trying to finally break free from his father. The film stars newcomers Giuliano Cruvaldi as the young Michael, and then Jafar Jackson, who is Michael's nephew. He's actually the son of Jermaine, his older brother, as Michael as an adult, mm-hmm. Both of whom are actually pretty good and quite difficult. It's very difficult, of course, to play somebody as famous and mm-hmm. as talented as Michael Jackson as a performer. You also have Coleman Domingo as his father, Nia Long as his mother. And in a very surprising turn, Miles Teller as his attorney, John Branco. Mm. And I didn't even recognize Miles mm-hmm. Teller, actually, when the first time I saw it. And and that's basically the film. It's a very typical sort of biopic in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously this film's profiling, as you said, Mark, arguably one of the most famous musicians of all time. Mm. He was widely beloved, still is widely beloved, but also someone who has had multiple child molestation allegations over the later part of his life before his early death in 2009 at the age of 50. How does the film handle Jackson's troubled legacy? And also, what did you think of the film overall?
Yeah, basically it doesn't deal with it at all. And this film is directed by Antoine Fuqua and written by John Logan, both of whom have a lot of impressive credits, actually, in their resumes. But really, they're not the author of this film. This film is authored by the Jackson estate, because to make a movie about Michael Jackson, you need to have the rights to the music of Michael Jackson, which they have. And so, and they're not going to allow the rights to any music without kind of authorizing everything in the movie. And it's very typical of these kind of biographical films to basically turn into what film critics like to call hagiographies, these kind of lives of the, where the person is like sainted and like any flaws or detriments are downplayed or ignored. This film takes it to a new level, though, really. He is almost a saint, literally almost like a saintly, almost like deified figure. And his father, basically, it's all projected onto the father. All the bad is onto him. So it's very much a good versus evil kind of structure. And that just doesn't work dramatically at all. Like, and I really felt sorry for Coleman Domingo, who's a great actor who has to play the father, because there's nothing to the role. He's just irredeemable, basically. There's no, and I mean, I'm sure, and I know Joe Jackson is not a good person, but that doesn't make a, you have to make the movie more, you know, like more complicated than that. And it just isn't. So it's a pretty terrible movie in that sense. But, and this is almost like a metaphor for Michael Jackson as a whole, the music's really good. And when the, and Jafar Jackson's quite good as Michael. And when it's a musical, which it is at points, like a musical performances, it's quite good. And watch it in like IMAX or a Dolby Cinema. It's, yeah, it'll get you moving in your seat kind of thing. So it is. So, yeah, like I don't even know if it's a mixed review for me. It's a, basically like it's two movies. Like when it's the biopic part, it's quite bad. When it's a musical, it's quite good. It's about half and half, maybe. And so, yeah, it's a really, a very divided film. And one that, I can't really, I don't even know if I can recommend. I guess if you're a fan of Michael Jackson's music, you'll probably like it. There's a reason it's doing as well as it's doing. So, but yeah, just not a, not a great film by any means. But yeah, it is, if you are going to see it in the theater, that's the only way it works at all.
Well, Jason, before we wrap up briefly, I want to ask, are you a Michael Jackson fan? Did you go and see it? What did you think of the film?
I'm a huge Michael Jackson fan. I hated the movie. The music's just incredible, absolutely. But everything else about it, I really dislike. I just really, I had real issues with it. It's just complete idolization. And, you know, there are these scenes that are just plain old, just weird, and made me feel really uncomfortable, you know, him in like toy shops and like hospitals and, you know, given the accusations there, I just really struggled with that, you know. And yeah, and there's also the reference to his kind of, to the plastic surgery as well. He goes and, you know, has an operation, comes back, and then that's it. You know, it's never talked about for the rest of the movie. And it's just, I just think, it's so superficial. And yet you do have these musical numbers. I love the beginning. I was like buzzing, you know, just hearing his music again. And it is so cinematic. And yet the film itself is utter garbage. So, you know,
It reminded me a lot of Bohemian Rhapsody and Elvis, both of them, which are not
Bohemian Rhapsody
very
was better than this.
I don't know. I think that movie's pretty bad.
It has problems. It has problems. Although what I liked about Bohemian Rhapsody is that great climatic kind of, you know, performance, right, of the song Bohemian Rhapsody at the end of, you know, the end of the film. This, it just kind of ends, actually, this movie. You don't have that kind of...
Well, it ends in, like, promises a sequel too. It's like very, very clearly, many, like, you know, one of those films. Like, it literally says his story continues.
Yeah, it says his story continues, and then you sit through the credits and listen to his music, but it's obviously not a visual thing. I didn't like it at all.
But we'll have
I just listened to his music on my iPhone.
We'll have to have you both back on for Michael too. It sounds like. That's where we have to leave today's movie spotlight for this week. Jason Betteraise, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And Mark Raymond, always great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. But we'll be back next week with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. Korea 24 is produced by Daria Kim, Yoon So-hyun, and Kim Bum-soo. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, take care and goodbye.